We're very excited to have him here. He's very knowledgeable on many, many subjects. He has a PhD from Harvard in Sanskrit and Indian studies. Is that correct?
That's what they told me.
Was the fastest PhD in the history of Harvard, isn't it?
That department.
In that department.
Never was there a student so desperate to
get out. So I'm sure you can all enjoy it, and I'd like you all to just welcome our guest.
Say it again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there music playing?
Yes. So there's a restroom, and you can go to reach the restroom out through the kitchen.
Yes, that way.
It's that way, on the other side of the building.
Just keep going until you find a room that looks like a restroom.
Thanks.
So, I would like to approach this topic of how spiritual values or spirituality is relevant to the modern times by... I'd like to approach this in sort of in a broad historical context. And first I'll make a few claims, which I hope I can sneak by you. The first is that, hey, how are you? Yeah, I was looking for you. No problem. So we're just starting. Anumanta, you want to repeat that introduction? No, we won't do that. So, in general, civilizations or societies are based upon metaphysical assumptions. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Let's say, for example, you live in a small town, and people in that town are very proud that there are no traffic lights in town. And so one day, town has grown a bit, so someone decides we need a traffic light here. Now, even a simple decision like that, to put a traffic light in, is a trade-off between freedom and security. When you put a traffic light in, it curtails your freedom to just drive through. So your freedom has been somewhat curtailed, and there is the authority of the state, which tells you, you must stop. Even if there's no one around you, you have to stop, and now you can go. And in exchange for that encroachment upon your freedom, you are supposed to receive, let's say, a greater degree of security, because now it's safer to drive by that particular intersection. So the trade-off between security and freedom, in a sense, is one of the most basic values in society, because if you, let's say if you just lived by yourself in the wilderness, you would have tremendous freedom. You could do almost anything up on top of a mountain by yourself. There would be no traffic signs or, you know, you could basically do what you want, but then on the other hand, you would not have all the facilities that come with society, such as lighted roads and schools and, you know, the convenience of all kinds of conveniences. So the very moment we decide, so to speak, to come down from the mountain and live in society, we are, as soon as we decide to do that, in a sense, we ourselves are making a value judgment that the value of living in proximity to other people is greater than the value of the relatively absolute freedom I might have if I simply lived alone. So values, for example, freedom or security, these are, you could say the value of freedom or the value of security, these are not physical facts. You could say that if, let's say, no one breaks into your home or someone does break into your home, those are simply physical facts. You could say that in a particular city there was so much crime or there was so little crime, and that itself is simply a physical fact. to say that there's value in that, to say that there's value in living in a city where there's low crime, or there's a lesser value in living in a city with greater crime, that value is not a physical fact. It's not something you can put your hands on or measure or weigh, or you can't study its atomic structure. It's just a value. It's a value you hold. And so if you think about it, society itself is based on a series of values or value assumptions or premises. To give it now, a philosopher Hume, I'm getting to the topic of the lecture, but I wanted to give some background so we could talk about it in a way which goes a little deeper than USA Today. Actually, I didn't mean to take a dig at USA Today. I mean, they have a lot of interesting articles, but so there was a Scottish philosopher, David Hume, who was quite controversial because in the late 18th century he was somewhat of an atheist, which was scandalous back then. And perhaps his main contribution to Western philosophy is that he pointed out, or he thought he was demonstrating, that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. In other words, let's go back to the traffic. Let's say in your town they put up a traffic light. So the fact that there have been so many accidents in the last year, which is more than there had been before because the population increased and so on, that is a fact. It's a physical fact in the world. To say there would be value in reducing the number of accidents, that's something you bring to the physical facts. The physical facts themselves don't tell you that. They simply tell you there were so many accidents. What we bring to those facts is that we value security, we value the sanctity of human life and other lives, other forms of life, that we want our children to be safe, we want everyone to be safe. Those values, valuing life and security and so on, we bring those values to the set of the physical facts. The physical facts can't create those values. They can simply trigger value judgments on your part by giving you relevant information which leads you to apply the values you already hold. So, I mean, why is this important? The reason this is important is because I think to some extent Hume was reacting to a more or less a Christian worldview which pervaded Europe at his time. And people thought the idea, of, let's say, of natural philosophy, the idea that if you just study nature, nature will tell you about God. So that, because as Europe came out of the Dark Ages, it became popular to say that, well, in the Dark Ages, and I think they kind of earned that name, the Dark Ages. It was a name given to them, actually, many, many centuries ago during the Renaissance. I think people like Erasmus and... early Renaissance thinkers themselves called it the Dark Ages. But the idea was, as they were coming out of the Dark Ages, they said, look, we have two books. We not only have the Bible, which for a long time in Europe was really the only authoritative source of knowledge. So if you wanted, so for example, historical linguistics during the Middle Ages, like why do we have so many languages on Earth, the reason was not, I mean, this was not explained in terms of any linguistic theory, it was explained in terms of the Tower of Babel. So if the Tower of Babel explains why there are so many languages in the world. So anyway, it became popular to say that actually God has given us two books. Come on in.
Hi.
Don't worry, we haven't come to the car chase scene yet. So. So, as Europe was coming out of the Dark Ages and starting to really become enthusiastic about being rational and intelligent and all that, it became popular to say that God has given us two books. One is the Bible, the other is the book of nature. That nature itself is an open book, and so this notion of natural theology, that you you can discover God and discover the truths about God simply by looking at nature, not with reference to a particular ideology or theology or dogma, but simply by studying nature. And so, I mean, to some extent, I think it was in response to this enthusiasm. It was in response to this enthusiasm that Hume said, the philosopher Hume, that nature doesn't really tell you anything. Nature just gives you a set of physical facts. And you cannot derive a metaphysical fact, such as a value, from the physical facts, which we've already explained. Don't worry, it plays, it goes around again. Just wait. So, now, I'll give you an example. Oh, the cell phone announcement. Feel free to get up and dance. Your cell phone. So, I'll give you an example of a very famous document written by an intelligent American, in this case, in which the author was fully aware that you can't derive a metaphysical fact of value, justice, freedom, and so on, from mere physical facts. So the name of the document is the Declaration of Independence. And the author, of course, is Thomas Jefferson, the main author. So Jefferson, being a very learned person, and being more or less a contemporary of Hume, did not try to argue for freedom and equality on the basis of physical facts. Because, for one thing, you can't do it. I mean, just try to prove empirically that we're equal. So we're not equal physically or artistically or intellectually. We're actually all different. Everyone has their gift, but we have different gifts. So it's interesting that our political system, democracy, which we have now in the most gentle way exported to other places, it's interesting that our political system, although we live in an age of secular democracy, meaning that you can't bring religious assumptions into the political arena, the public arena, it's interesting that our democracy is based squarely on a religious assumption. So we have secular democracy based on a religious assumption. A great irony which somehow escapes everyone. So in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson argued that we hold these truths to be self-evident. Poor Aria, she's heard, she's been traveling with us, and she's probably heard this about a million times. She could probably sit down and give a lecture. Anyway, so self-evident, I'll do a quick version so I won't torture the people that have been traveling with me. Self-evident is a technical philosophical term, which means something that proves itself. You can't, so you don't, you can't say that, oh, well, how do you know that? Prove that. Because to say something is self-evident means it proves itself. Otherwise, whatever I say, you could say prove it. I could say we're in the state of Georgia, you could say prove it. And I could say, well, ask anyone you meet on the street. And then you could say, well, they're all as bewildered as you are. There's a case of mass delusion going on here. And I could say, well, look, all the newspapers say Georgia, and I could, and you could say, well, you just planted those. In other words, then I have to prove that, no, these people, I have to, you know, maybe get psychological tests for the people or show that I have no control of the newspapers. And it could go on and on and on. It's absurd. It's extremely silly. But you could just keep pushing people back and back, saying, well, how do you know that? Well, how do you know that? We'll prove this. We'll prove that. So as Aristotle pointed out, the way you stop an infinite regress of proofs is by declaring that something is self-evident. So that's what Jefferson did. That's why he started with that language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. What's interesting here is Jefferson, unlike Jimmy Carter, and I hate to criticize Jimmy Carter just a stone's throw from his presidential center, but anyway, with all due respect to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter sort of launched the program in America, or popularized the program of human rights. And just human rights. So, very simply, because I want to get on with this, that I think you could argue that how do you derive rights, political rights, social rights, which are metaphysical things? You can't hold something up and say this is a right. A right is a value judgment. And you get a bunch of people that all believe that we have rights, Or you could say, even if no one believes it, we still have them. Even if no one believes we have rights, if you were the last sane person alive on earth and everyone else was a fascist, you could say that even though no one believes me, even though I can't prove it to anyone, it's still an objective fact that we have rights. That's the nature of human life, we have rights. So the question would be, where do the rights come from? If you say they're human rights, human refers to our anatomy. We are anatomically human. So how do you derive a right, which is a metaphysical fact, from a human anatomy, which is a physical fact? And this is Hume's whole point. How do you get metaphysical truths from mere physical data? Therefore, to avoid this problem, and Carter, I think, just was not quite as learned in philosophy as Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson was aware of this problem. And therefore, he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident that we're created equal. The Creator has given us these rights. It's a self-evident fact, a fact that proves itself, that a Creator, a God, has given us these rights. They're inalienable because no one has authority over God. So no one can take away what God has given. Now, coming to the modern society, we have a situation in America at the present time where we have a kind of a catch-22. We have, in America, we've developed a secular democracy, which means that the public sphere should be free of any type of religiosity, although that's being kind of like softened now. So I think that the relevance of spirituality is, and now I'll get to directly the topic, but I wanted to give this background. I think the relevance of spirituality is that without agreement among people on certain spiritual values, you cannot have a moral society. It just degrades into the law of the jungle. Might makes right. I said the democracy, American democracy, is based on a religious assumption. That's equality, because there's no empirical evidence for this. If I say to anyone, how do you know that we're equal in the face of massive, virtually infinite evidence of our inequality, materially, in terms of our abilities or whatever, we don't get all the same scores on tests and things, in the face of this virtually infinite evidence that we are empirically unequal, how do we know that beyond this unlimited empirical evidence, there is a metaphysical fact which stands above an infinite amount of material science and reveals that we are actually equal? So, if we are true to the spirit of secular democracy and we say don't bring in any religious assumptions, then the question is, how do you know we're equal? How do you know we're equal? Now, I just don't see it. If we remove all metaphysical assumptions like those of Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence that we're created equal, the Creator has given us rights. If we take that away, and by the way, Jefferson really couldn't use that today in court. I mean, the Declaration of Independence would more or less be thrown out of court, an American court. Because if you go into an American court and try to say that this is true because of a Creator, that'll be thrown out immediately. It's kind of like tragedy and comedy at the same time. For example, there's all these debates. Well, in some parts of the country, there are debates about teaching evolution theory and teaching, what do they call it, intelligent design. Now, what's interesting is that the courts, which are the judges who are apparently free of any contamination of serious education, it's interesting that these judges rule consistently that intelligent design should not be taught because we have to have separation of church and state. What's interesting is that intelligent design theory is actually a perennial philosophical position which was put forward forth by some of the greatest philosophers in Western history many centuries before Christianity existed. In other words, if you look at the history of philosophy, long before there was anything such as Christianity, this was put forward as a philosophical position. And philosophers throughout history, all throughout the world, have put this forward as a secular philosophical position, yet the courts are not aware of this. And they are so sort of like spooked or so phobic, sort of theophobic, is a word I use. They are so theophobic, so afraid of anything that might like smack of a deity, that they say you should not teach anything in schools which makes any reference to, which tries to explain the creation by reference to a creator. Now, if that's true, then the Declaration of Independence should not be taught in schools. Because the Declaration of Independence teaches intelligent design of our rights. Intelligent design of our political system. So if that theory is no good, what happens to democracy? Anyway, these are amazing contradictions, but it's an amazing age. So what's needed, the relevance is that when you take spiritual values and push them into the private sphere, and so then the public sphere, as we've seen in history, is overrun by materialistic values, for example, consumerism, capitalism. Capitalism is not simply the theory that we should have a free market. You should know that in many, many ancient civilizations, many thousands of years ago throughout the world, they had free markets. You could go to town and sell something and make money and then buy something else. So free markets have existed, I think, most of the time in most places. I mean, there are certain times in history when you had, sort of an unusually psychotic leader as opposed to just a normally psychotic leader. But throughout history, there have been, in ancient India and ancient Europe, there was trade. People could buy and sell things. So capitalism didn't bring us the notion of a free market. Capitalism is much more than that. It's an ism in the real sense of the word. It's an ideology. And the ideology is, it's an all-encompassing ideology which claims that the highest public value is capital. So if you, for example, have to sell out your country in order to make money, what can you do? It's your moral duty to make the money. I'll get over it. I know how to write well. So if you look at... just give one simple example. Karl Marx, the late great Karl Marx. He was a good historian and kind of a terrible prophet. I won't go into Karl Marx. It's another topic. But Karl Marx's contribution, perhaps his main historical insight, was that the means of production determine social relations. So that in hunting and gathering societies, they tend to have certain kinds of social organizations and authority structures. Then when you have people turn to agriculture, for various reasons, you find different kinds of governments, different kinds of social hierarchies and everything. And then when you have an industrial revolution, it produces another kind of society. So now we see in the world, because we have increasingly a global economy, it's sort of dragging the world's political structures behind it. But in any case, this global economy, people in America or other places, they do what's best for their company. They do what's best for the accumulation of capital. It may mean losing American jobs. It may mean destroying the environment. It may mean whatever it means. The point is, there is a sacred right to accumulate capital. So, because spiritual values have sort of been pushed into the private sphere, if you think, for example, that people should be generous instead of greedy, if you think that we should maintain a higher standard of decency because scientific studies prove that when children are exposed to certain levels of promiscuity and violence and so on, that it actually kind of messes their heads up and makes them more inclined towards certain types of self-destructive and antisocial behavior. All of this it's so much, but it's just your opinion. Well, that's your value. Like decency, that's just your opinion. Or compassion, that's just, well, if you value compassion, that's fine, but you can't require the state to be compassionate. And so on. So the relevance is that we have to somehow or other establish the objectivity of certain higher values. Because if not, then the lower values sort of win the day. And everyone is... I don't know if I'm getting through, but you cannot derive, as I said, you cannot derive metaphysical facts from physical facts. So if we want a just society, a society of justice and compassion, so that it's not merely social Darwinism, like freedom of opportunity. So if you lost the race and you're humiliated and poverty stricken, that's the way it goes. You have the same chance as everybody else to run the race. A society where it's basically everyone against everyone. Everyone competing against everyone. And the privatization of God. So, spirituality somehow there's a need to re-spiritualize society, to teach spiritual knowledge. People themselves have to be, in whatever way they're able to, spiritual practitioners. Because to be a spiritual practitioner simply means that you recognize that everything about you cannot be explained in terms of dead matter. That the essence of who you are, the fact that you're a person at all, the fact that you're conscious, consciousness, the fact that you have, you can understand spiritual things that cannot be explained in terms of atoms and molecules, and that your only real chance to achieve deep understanding and the deepest happiness and perennial life, the only chance you have to prolong your existence beyond the very unpredictable fate of this body, the only real area in which you can pursue these higher goals is in the area of spirituality. And that really we must bring our best intelligence, our greatest diligence, our greatest sincerity to this endeavor of trying to understand spiritual life. Trying to understand the source of our own existence. Where do we come from? How do we exist at all? And what is the ultimate goal of life? And so on. And to try as far as possible to build a society in which these things are actually valued and not merely privatized and for public purposes trivialized and then discarded. Anyway, before going on, perhaps you may have some questions or comments, because I don't want to just go on and on assuming that everyone is right there with me. So any questions or comments regarding these topics?
The same comment I made some months ago about correspondence.
Yes.
The two theories of truth are correspondence. That is to say, if I say something is true, it means that the thing I say is true exists or obtains in the world. And then there's the coherence theory of truth, which says that something is true if it's integrated with the other truths in the system. And in other words, in which, sort of like Kant said, that the golden rule, which is pretty much what Kant was talking about when he was talking about moral imperatives, is that if we apply this rule to everyone, if everyone acted in this way, would society be destroyed or would it be void up?
Right.
And that's kind of a coherence theory of truth, and I'm just wondering if the Constitution couldn't have been based on that we hold these truths to be self-evident, and instead of going on to say because we're endowed with our Creator, but we hold this truth to be self-evident because to think otherwise would cause the collapse of civilization.
That sounds like what Plato said, we should tell people lies if necessary in order to get them to behave properly. In his Republic, Plato says that if necessary, you should tell the mass of people stories, lies, fantasies. For example, I just saw, flying from Houston to LA, I saw a very interesting movie called Miss Potter with Renee Zellweger. Anyway, it's irrelevant to me. It's about a writer, the lady who created Peter Rabbit in England over 100 years ago. And so apparently in the English countryside at that time, parents would tell their children that there are sort of evil spirits in the forest that take away dirty children, children that are dirty, but they never take away clean children. Or, you know, you talk about a tooth fairy or... So, as we know, adults sometimes tell children stories in order to get them to behave properly. I remember my mother trying to get me to take medicine, telling me that the spoon with the medicine in it was a train, a choo-choo train, and my mouth was a tunnel or something. The train had to go through the tunnel. So, I mean, I don't really resent her for saying that. It wasn't like a malicious lie. She was just trying to give me my medicine. But now the question is, should we tell adults, or even children, should we tell people all kinds of stories we know are false? Should we treat people in general like children and tell them stories? I'm not sure that's what Jefferson was doing.
I think they could have written the Constitution with the clause the way I stated it, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, because they are self-evident, because in the system of humanity and civilization, to do otherwise than to accord people human rights and these basic rights is self-defeating and
no, but it wouldn't be self-defeating. See, philosophically, that wouldn't do it. Because someone could come along and say, as Callicles said, that it's not. Because I am a wannabe tyrant. Ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a political tyrant. And, you know, I traded political tyrant cards and everything when I was a kid. And so... So if we don't have these rights and people lose their rights, that's all very good. In fact, the people in general are ignorant. They don't know what's good for them. And what they need is a benevolent dictator like myself. So...
But that's why they were leaving England.
It's one thing to say here's a group of people that value certain things and here are people that value other things. But that doesn't make it philosophically coherent. You can't say that this is true philosophically because I value it. And this is bad because I don't value it. You're just giving your opinion. What Jefferson was trying to do was not simply say what he valued and what he didn't value. And to say that everybody else should value what I value and not value what I don't value. He was saying that it is an objective truth. Jefferson was claiming that people in a reasonably lucid state of consciousness, people who are not really just completely in ignorance, can perceive the fact that there's a creator. That this is something that people can, that is actually evident. If you look out at the world, if you look within yourself, if you look wherever you can, it's self-evident. You can perceive, you can understand directly the presence of a creator. And the will of a creator, or the gift that from that creator of certain rights. So for the people like Jefferson and others in Europe and other people in America, it was just, you could just look at us and look within yourself and understand that God has given me certain rights. They felt that that's a fact that any person can understand just by a little thinking about it.
One other thought. In Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, he speaks of the occurrence of complexity in nature in every instance that we've seen arises from lesser complexity giving rise to more complexity rather than greater complexity creating lesser complexity. In other words, if you're positing this extremely complex or powerful God giving rise to creation, we haven't seen evidence of that.
So when a plant, let's say if you take a plant and the plant dies and begins to disintegrate.
But we see in evolution the opposite.
But as far as that book is concerned, I looked over it. He doesn't appear to be a very serious philosopher. I was just in the UK actually lecturing earlier this year, and so there were university students in the UK that said, oh, we don't take that book seriously because Dawkins is just a propagandist. That's just begging the question. The question is, did God make the world a certain way or did it evolve? If you say that the reason you go from simple to more complex is through evolution, and that proves that there's evolution, I mean, that is like an amazing case of circular reasoning. Another problem with Dawkins' book is that he seems to think that Christianity is God, or in the sense that he doesn't address world religions, doesn't address Eastern traditions. He just basically grew up in a certain tradition and thinks that that speaks for all the religions of the world. But I don't think it's a very serious book.
Yeah, I'm not here to defend the book, just at one point.
Yes, Louise?
I would like for you to talk more about intelligent design and the philosophers that had it long ago.
Plato, for one, mm-hmm. who, as far as I know, is not a Christian, since he lived several centuries before Jesus.
Specifically, how did he talk about intelligent design? I don't remember it. I've read Plato.
Yes, specifically, I remember reading Plato that he talks about, he explains that there are, you know, there's sort of like the top-down and bottom-up theory of things. I mean, all of Plato speaks to that, because all of Plato is that there are eternal forms, and that the forms in this world are mere reflections of those forms. And it's the fact that those eternal forms of everything are intelligible, they sort of speak, give a sort of limited, somewhat perverted intelligibility of things of this world.
He didn't say they were intelligent, he just said that they were perfect forms.
No,
they
Plato has his two sides. On the one hand, Plato the geometer, just talking about the, you know, perfect triangles or perfect horses, this and that. But then there's Plato the theist, Plato, who is deeply concerned with God. And God is not merely a form; God is a living, conscious thing. So that if you look at Plato's last work, The Laws, for example, the last thing he wrote. It's basically, he proposes a religious state where every month the community should have a festival celebration. It should always be a religious celebration. And that the greatest offense in that ideal society would be to desecrate the sacred, and so on and so forth. So Plato had a very profound engagement with God, trying, and actually in certain of his dialogues he tries to reconcile his geometry with his theism.
Yes.
And of course he talks about purifying the soul.
And he also had a fascist state.
Oh, I'm not a Platonist.
Right.
I'm not a Platonist.
You can't just pick and choose. I mean, the Pope tells us not to go cafeteria shopping, and with Plato we can't sort of cafeteria shopping.
Actually, with all due respect to the Pope, who I'm sure believes that I'm a devil worshipper, especially this Pope, which speaks a lot for his broad-mindedness. I absolutely can cafeteria. I mean, that's exactly what I do. When I go to the store, I get what I want. Now, I don't accept Plato as a sacred revealed work. I just think Plato is very intelligent in many ways. In some ways, I disagree with it. So therefore, I have every right to take those aspects of Plato which I feel are relevant.
Which you agree with. And I take things that I agree with, too. And I actually agree with a lot of what Dawkins said, even though he's English and I'm Irish. He made a lot of good points, and yes, he was, of course, oriented towards Christianity, there's no question, because that's the world that he lives in. But my feeling about the Declaration of Independence is that really in those times, and Jefferson was a deist, not a Trinitarian, he did have a vague belief in God, but he also instructed his nephew to look through the Bible and read it carefully and reject it if he didn't believe in it, and reject those parts he didn't believe in. So he really was not, as many Christians today would like to say, was a believer in Christianity.
No, but that wasn't my point at all.
The creationism part, the creator part, I don't think that Jefferson would ever argue A, B, C, D, that you go from a creator to the rights of rights of freedom or the right to happiness, whatever. I don't think there's a linear argument there at all. I don't think we know that the Creator was a good guy.
From a philosophical point of view, putting aside, you know, Jefferson's personal beliefs, Jefferson laid out a philosophical argument. It's very much a linear argument. It's very much an argument where one point follows. It very much is A, B, C, D. Now, if you want to say that because historically Jefferson privately believed this or that, that's not really my concern. My concern is not simply the private life of Thomas Jefferson. Rather, my concern is that he laid out an argument. And I'm looking at that argument.
Did he manage to convince you that he thought that the Creator was somebody who defined
Jefferson said that we are endowed by the Creator with the rights. That's an explicit statement. So again, Jefferson's private life and so on. If, as a philosopher, I simply come to the Declaration of Independence, put the history aside, and because ultimately the history can't make it good philosophy or bad philosophy. A philosophical statement stands on its own merit. And so what I'm doing is I'm looking at those statements as a philosophical argument, and I'm analyzing how does this argument work. And the way it works is, first of all, by the declaration of self-evident truths to avoid an infinite regress of proofs. It's the first move he makes. The next philosophical move is to state what those philosophical truths are, that we are created equal. And what my concern was that as soon as you bring in this kind of language, and it doesn't matter, for the purpose of the philosophical analysis, it's actually irrelevant, whether it's deism or Trinitarianism, or whatever, it's actually not relevant. Because all I needed, all anyone needs actually, it's not simply my thing, all we need to make the point is that a creator be a metaphysical fact and not a physical fact. That's all.
But do we know he's good? I mean, as part of your argument, would you say that since Jefferson said good things about we're created equal and all that kind of happy stuff, do you feel that his creator, somehow he knew that the creator would sort of agree with that? I mean, did he have private information? Or was he on the internet with God? I mean, how did he know that because we are created?
Well, how, I could ask you something.
How did he know that we're created equal? I mean, did the creator tell him, or?
Well, Jefferson stated that. That's the first thing he said. He said it's a self-evident truth.
Right.
Now, for example, if I, let's say I'm walking down the street and I see someone attacking an innocent person, and I say, you can't do that, that's bad or evil or it's injustice, and I act to stop it. Who told me that's wrong? In other words, we take it for granted that we have all kinds of metaphysical insights.
Which developed through social evolution.
You see, again, we don't want to be quite that circular in our reason. You see, the whole issue is examining. See, the problem with saying that, I think this sort of gets into the topic of the talk tonight. So the problem with that theory that the reason we think that justice is good and injustice is bad, the reason we think that, let's say, rape and murder are bad and, you know, it's good to stop these things, is simply because evolution, this God of evolution, selected those qualities. Because societies that believed that flourished or survived more efficiently than societies that didn't believe that. There's two problems with this. Number one, I don't think it's a theory of history that you could prove through actual history. And number two, I don't think you can prove that history does favor certain kinds of societies above others in mere survival value. The second problem with it is that it actually completely distorts and twists what almost everybody deeply feels they know to be true. In other words, if I see someone attack an innocent person, a child, or any innocent person, I feel very deeply that this is wrong, this is evil, to harm this innocent person. Now, this extremely patronizing, paternalistic view that comes from the Dawkins of the world that's just because evolution, which can explain anything, you know, sort of made you think that. So the conclusion would be actually a monstrous type of amoral universe. In other words, when someone attacks an innocent child in the most horrible way, that's not really wrong. That's what Dawkins is telling us. It's not really wrong. And if we can design a society in which murdering children turns out to be good for the survival of a robust gene pool, then there would be no problem in murdering certain children. In fact, as we know, periodic forest fires make the forest stronger. If you talk to people that do forestry, you'll find that, I mean, I learned this in British Columbia, they have lots of trees, that because the Canadian government and the government of British Columbia is suppressing and suppressing and preventing forest fires, the reason, result is that the forests are becoming much weaker. So actually stopping the natural elimination of weaker elements in a gene pool actually makes that community weaker, whether it's a community of trees or people. So if we actually eliminated all those children or even adults among us who are physically weak or mentally weak, we could actually create a much stronger society. Now, I'm not in favor of this. I'm simply saying that the argument that a moral society would of course be selected for survival, I think is a silly interpretation of history. And I think it leads to a monstrous conclusion. That means all you need to do to justify murder, rape, torture, all you need to do is make sure you do it in a way which somehow protects the physical survival of the species. That's all you need to do. If you can show that you're raping and murdering in a way that doesn't interfere with the brute survival of the species, then no one can say anything to you. There's nothing wrong with raping and murdering. And that follows directly from the arguments of people like Dawkins. And now, I'm not arguing that we shouldn't accept Dawkins simply because the consequences are monstrous, and they are monstrous. I'm making another point. I'm making, you could say, almost an epistemological point. And that is, when we look inside ourselves, it's like, how do you know there's a real world outside of your mind? How do you know that you should love your children and not eat them? And then produce other children that may be healthier than the ones you ate. The point is that whenever anyone claims to know anything, even something as theoretical and unobservable as the original evolution of species, which does not repeat itself all the time, and we can't just, you know, go somewhere and watch species evolving in the relevant macro sense. And so therefore, how do we know anything? How do we know that there's a real world? How do we know other people exist? You see, when you get into a meta-epistemological discussion, how do you know anything? How do you know you're really from Ireland? How do you know that you weren't programmed to think that? So what it will come down to, just to make a long story short, is that we do believe strongly that we have certain powers of understanding such that in certain cases we can fairly say that we know something. That's a simple version of it. And by the deepest powers that we have of knowing, by powers as deep as the power which tells us that there's a real world, we know that certain acts are evil, such as brutality against innocent people. And to tell us that these acts are not truly evil, that simply we've been fooled by our own genes, that certain sort of like magician genes that kind of do tricks and pull rabbits out of hats, that certain genes have been selected because they delude us into thinking that it is actually wrong to kill your own children. And that's just a delusion. It's not really wrong, it's just that nature has selected genes that trick us into thinking that. Personally, I think that this is a monstrous idea. I think it contradicts our deepest intuitions. There's no proof of it. It has never been observed that that's the case. And so to go for absolute moral relativism on the basis of a theory which has never been proved, to me, is really twisted. That's how I see it. And it's a theory which simply trashes all of the spiritual wisdom of all time and says that any time in history, whether a Buddha or a Jesus or a Krishna or a Moses, anyone in all of history, anyone, you or me, anyone that ever thought they had a legitimate spiritual insight was deluded. People that teach this, I think, are not healthy people. That's my view. And to say that they're persuasive, I think, is fantastic.
I don't want to disturb your talk. I think that's fine. Thank you very much.
We can talk later. I was in Ireland, actually, earlier this year.
Yes, so I was told. I hope you enjoyed it.
Very much.
I've got lots of good Irish whiskey.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't verify that. So, anything else? Well, if not, then I guess I... Excuse me? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, just carry on with your talk. I the idea of intelligent design, but, you know, because...
We mentioned Plato. So it's the idea that... to me, it's a very, very, very simple thing. That... let's say we don't know. Let's say for a minute that none of us really knows if someone designed the universe or if it just happens to be that way. Let's say we don't know that. What we do know with certainty is that the more intelligent someone is, the more sophisticated their ability to design things. So that a child may design a little sandcastle or something, but a more intelligent person, adult, can design a real castle. The more intelligent people are, the more sophisticated their designs are. That's what we do know. Let's say the universe, no one knows. So let's look at that realm in which we do know things. We can look at the dams made by beavers or the honeycombs made by bees. And we can see that... So then when we come to something we don't know, it seems to me it's simply more natural to reason from what we know to what we don't know rather than from reasoning from what we don't know to what we don't know. Because if you want to be like really hard-nosed empiricist, we don't know where the species came from, we don't know if there's a God. Let's just talk about real hard-line empiricism, things we can really observe and repeatedly observe, and nothing else, not the very soft areas of science where they bend all the rules in order to fit in their sort of God-slaying theories. So it seems to me reasoning, as a general principle, reasoning from what you know to what you don't know is stronger than reasoning from what you don't know to what you don't know. And the fact that some people have dedicated their lives, like over my dead body, will you reason from what you know to what you don't know, indicates to me that something psychological is going on more than something philosophical. It's common to say that, religion is a crutch or God is a crutch. I think atheism can be a huge crutch. Because what's the payoff? The payoff of atheism is you get to believe that there's no one in the universe better than you. It's like you are free to be unlimitedly vain and humanistic. It's like you get to eliminate any higher power with the authority to judge you. And for some people, that is a gigantic payoff. So to say, to use this somewhat infantile theory, well, I take back the somewhat, that people choose to be religious simply because of psychological weakness, or they're the kind of people who prefer a secure slavery to a dangerous freedom, and therefore they want to subjugate themselves to this terrible power which at least gives them security. Now, some people may do that. There's all psychological types that come to religion, and there's all psychological types that come to atheism. But to say that atheism or this type of scientific materialism is simply an objective, neutral, disinterested, intellectual conclusion, I think is hilarious. Especially, as McLuhan pointed out in his book, The Nature of Scientific Revolutions, that the history of science shows extreme emotional attachment to theories, the systematic rejection of contradictory theories on emotional grounds, the differential treatment of evidence. Until, I mean, there's these like wars between different theories, and finally someone's overthrown or the other group dies out. The history of science, as scholars are now well aware in fields like the sociology of knowledge and the philosophy of science, it's a very, very well-known fact that if you study the history of science, you often find anything but disinterested, totally neutral, sifting of objective facts. I mean, that is, anyone that thinks that is extremely innocent of any study of the philosophy and history of religion, of science. I mean, philosophy and history of science, the sociology of knowledge, they're just like completely innocent of any study in those fields. In fact, some friends of mine wrote a book which became a bestseller called Forbidden Archaeology, in which they showed, they actually, for the first time, brought together all of the archaeological studies, sort of collected them, for human antiquity. And they showed that the most solid, powerful, undeniable evidence for a much greater antiquity for human beings on Earth was simply thrown out, literally, physically just thrown out. Scientist, one lady, I forget her name, but she was a scientist at a very good university in the United States, went down to Mexico, found some data that was much older than it should have been. And she did everything according to the most strict, pure methodology. She had other scientists come in and verify that everything was done properly. And because she wouldn't throw away her report, she lost her job, she was blackballed. So I mean, you can give hundreds of examples, thousands of examples. There's absolutely no denying, objectively, that the so-called scientific enterprise is filled with all kinds of emotional attachments.
But there are some scientists who, like Galileo and Darwin,
yes,
who really had to fight huge emotional battles.
Mm-hmm.
Galileo was put under house arrest most of his life. Darwin struggled for 30 years, mainly because his wife was a believer in fraternity. And he sat on his theory for 30 years, and it's well documented in his diaries that indeed he had these thoughts about natural selection.
Right.
Which to his mind sort of, I guess, abolished the need for God. And he was so concerned about his wife's beliefs and the general feelings in England at the time that he sat on it. So also there's a book, is it The Nature of Scientific Revolution? By a guy who I actually knew, went to MIT, and he talks about the changing paradigms and the struggles that occurred with Copernicus with everyone.
But okay, everyone. Let's, one second. I mean, we know Galileo is definitely the poster boy for the repression of science.
Right.
And there's a whole history to that, actually, which we could discuss later, which is actually very interesting, how the Catholic Church, which had been much more liberal, became much more conservative as part of the Counter-Reformation. But anyway, the poster boys. What about the hundreds and thousands, if not millions of people who lost their jobs or could not get jobs unless they sold out their beliefs in something spiritual? In other words, if we study the history of the West, what we find is there was one tyranny, which was the tyranny of the church, which was gradually overturned and replaced by another academic tyranny, which was the tyranny of at least methodologically atheistic materialism. Now, if you're in the academy and you want to get a job, even if you want to teach high school, if you want to teach in college, if you want to get a job, you'd better hide any even intellectual conviction you may have, never mind religion. So the secular scientific repression of metaphysics is no less than the previous Christian suppression and repression of views. So, I mean, the church has passed the baton to the materialists who have been no less repressive, no less willing to ruin careers, and so on. So what we need here is a synthesis, not an antithesis. We have a historical thesis. You know, in Hegelian terms, historical thesis was fanatical religion, which I personally don't want to relive. I mean, not that I ever was a religious fanatic, but I mean, wouldn't want our world to relive it. I mean, it was... I mean, if you get me started on that topic, I'll really get excited about the atrocities and everything. So, on the one hand, you have this religious fanaticism. Now, as Newton said, every action produces an equal and opposite reaction. And that also is true culturally. It's not merely with dead things. It's true culturally. So, the sort of born-again materialism, which came to rule the academy, the evangelical evolutionism, is simply the equal and opposite reaction. Equally fanatic, equally... I remember, as an alumnus, I get this Harvard magazine, which they send me. I guess in the hope they have it, I will, you know, give them money. Sure. What do they say? Prime in the well, the pump. So, anyway, I remember in one edition, and it's a good magazine, it's done by a Harvard professor, so they reviewed a book, sociology book, which was printed by University of California Press. And this book compared the mutual attitudes between the Christian right and the academic left. And what they found was that one of the main differences was that the academic left was more closed-minded, that the Christian right, believe it or not, was more open to opposing viewpoints in the academic left. I can give you, as many examples. You want me to stay here all night giving examples of the intellectual fascism of the academic left. So what's needed now is a synthesis. We need open-mindedness, principled inclusivism is what I call it. Because if you just include everything without principles, you can't have a curriculum. But we need a principled inclusivism. Not fanatical religion, not fanatical materialism, but true open-mindedness to all the great ideas of history and an open discussion of them. And Dawkins, as anyone knows or reads him, is not part of the synthesis. He's unwittingly.
He's a typical, very articulate Brit, and I think a lot of Brits are very clever at making one-liner points. So I think he falls into somewhat the provocateur, but if you really want a provocateur, read Hitchens' book on God, which is really provocative. I think Dawkins really, to me, I've got to confess, my wife says that I either read the introduction or read one-third of a book. I've read one-third of Dawkins, so... Again, and then she says, I talk like an expert. So I haven't got the end, honestly, of what the guy says. So far he's okay, and my only concern is that he's very long-winded. He talks about why people, the beliefs that people have, what they put forward as their reason for believing in God. And there are 10,000 beliefs, and I'm not interested in
why. But why not put forward the reasons for not believing in God? Why can't that be equally reduced down to psychology?
To me, it's ridiculous. I'm uninterested in why other people... I want to know what the philosophical or theoretical arguments are. I'm uninterested in the fact that Joe Blow believes because some ridiculous reason. So I would say I find him long-winded and redundant so far. But that doesn't say he's untrue. But we shouldn't be discussing Dawkins anyway.
Yes.
He's English. We don't want to discuss him.
Yes, please.
Yes, you bring an interesting argument. Making the blending of these two opposites. What do you see the action plan or what society would have to do and how? How would it happen?
Yes. To some extent it is happening. History is going that way. And for example, just one little symptom of it, there are more and more conferences on science and religion. And it's science is taking religion more seriously. The latest theories in science are kind of getting mystical and metaphysical and multiple universes and the influence of the observer on the observed and all this stuff, mind over matter. So actually history is already going that way. But I think the good people like yourself and others I think we just have to, in whatever way we can, try to ourselves become spiritually progressive, because that's really what life is about. It's like, if I don't get into spirituality, I already know the end of the movie. And, you know, it's not a happy ending. It's like one day you drop dead or roll over or collapse or something. So the only way the movie is still interesting is if you're actually pursuing some spiritual truth. Then it opens your life up into an infinite realm. Otherwise, it's just, so it's like those adventure movies that people are trapped, you know, on some planet or in some cavern, and they're trying to get back to the Earth or trying to get back to Minneapolis or whatever. And let's say that there's only one possibility, like, I don't know if we can make this thing fly, but it's our only hope before our food supply runs out. Or I don't know if people on Earth will get the signal we're sending, but it's our only hope. So, I mean, typically, you go for it. If that's your only hope, you try for it. Now, there is the idea that science could make us eternal. That's not really working out so well. Yeah, but here you have these extraordinary claims made by apparently wise, good people, giving us all this, you know, all these great saints from many different traditions around the world saying, look, there's this incredible reality. You can be part of it. You can reach an eternal life of wisdom and bliss. It's like, if that's the possibility, why wouldn't I pursue that? All science is based on this. Whenever you begin a scientific search or research, you don't know exactly what you're going to find. But if you're a scientist, you feel, in terms of investigating the physical world, this is the methodology we have. I don't know if this investigation, let's say I'm trying to find a cure for cancer, or I'm trying to find something. I mean, I don't know if I'll find it. But the only hope I have in terms of working with the physical elements is this methodology. So people dedicate their lives. Many scientists who are sincere and intelligent and I think have good motives spend their whole lives and don't find it. So in the same way, this is the possibility we have to reach the perfection of eternal life, of perfect knowledge, of perfect happiness. And so in the spirit of science, in the spirit of adventure, why wouldn't we try? And those who do try get extraordinary results. And they then encourage us to try. So go for it. And the more that you or I or anyone, the more that we can make real spiritual progress, the more that we can reasonably and persuasively encourage other people to do so. Yes.
There's a group actually that started out in India that's putting up and trying to get into the school systems and putting up schools to teach human values, not per se religion,
right,
or this set or that set,
right,
but trying and can get into the schools by the basis of teaching human values rather than labeling it, which seems to polarize people. Is that a possibility that you've seen happening, or make a difference?
Well, when I was a kid, they taught us certain values. I can't even know if that was school or the Boy Scouts. But you all right, Vic Vinton?
Well, if you'd expected for an old fool, I guess not.
Yeah, I mean, every bit helps. But I think, so, I mean, anything good is good. But I think history shows that ultimately people, to be deeply motivated, they have to actually see a big picture of something that can inspire them. We need spiritual science. We need, I mean, in a sense, we all perhaps indirectly approach that. But if I claim I'm a spiritual leader or I'm a spiritual practitioner, my behavior is, you could say, very hypocritical in the sense that I'm very greedy and lusty and vain and so on, then we sort of intuitively know that, well, if you're spiritual, somehow it should give you good character. You should be a good person. If you're not a good person, how could you really be in higher consciousness? So somehow or other, we make that connection between higher consciousness and virtuous behavior. So if we don't teach people the higher consciousness and simply the rules, it may lead to cynicism. Sorry for keeping you all so long here, but anything else that I could try to find?
Well,
Well, if not, then we have...
You were speaking about the intelligence behind the whole creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, like the same question that Louise was asking, I was just wondering how you can... anyway, it's the same question, a little bit more. I mean, you were already speaking about it, and then other topics come up, and then...
Oh, when I think of my own human body,
sorry.
No, that's all right. Nothing to be sorry about. I mean, consider your human body. Try to build one. It is. I mean, can you imagine a computer? Imagine if they could make gendered computers, and then you just leave your computers, you know, alone in your office overnight, and you come back in the morning. There's like a little baby computer. And then the baby computer grows and eventually... And imagine, in terms of industry, if we could develop like a computer or an airplane or a car or a plastic bucket, anything, where you just make two of them and gender them, and then... Imagine, for example, a machine. Imagine if your car... Imagine if cars, gendered cars, could produce other cars, you know, which first are born as subcompacts. gradually grow into full-size cars. And imagine a car which would just go out, you know, go out to the gas station and fuel itself, fix itself. I mean, consider something like unbelievable technology, like say a cow or a horse, where they just, you put them in the pasture and they just get their own fuel and the grass grows everywhere. The environment is such a fantastically, you know, the interconnectedness, your own human body, it's the technological sophistication of your body is absolutely mind-numbing. It just goes, you know what I mean? It's like millions and millions and millions of times more sophisticated than so many of our machines. It's like millions of times more sophisticated. And to think that just by the wind blowing and the rain falling and things colliding, that this body with this fantastically sophisticated technology arises from wind blowing and rain falling and you know, I don't know, stones colliding or earthquake. It's just, to me, it just seems like literally unbelievable. To me, the fact that people could believe that itself is a proof of God. Because it seems to me, unless God really bewildered such people, I think it would be humanly impossible to believe something so absurd. And to me, it's like the emperor has no clothes. It is so fantastically absurd. The fact that some people actually believe it, to me, is itself a proof of God. Because otherwise,
you've told us what is ridiculous
in my view.
Other beliefs. What is your own belief, your own spiritual belief, and how did you go from where you started off to where you are now?
Well, I'll give you the short version, because I don't want to be like, remember that movie Airplane, where that guy kept driving people to suicide by telling the story of his life? As a young student at Berkeley, I think I was trying to resolve or reconcile two things which I felt were true. I deeply felt were true. Oh, at the age of 18 or 19, I think I was, don't know how articulately I thought about this, about anything at that age. But one is I think I had a deep understanding that there's some kind of God. At the same time, that's when Eastern mysticism, to use sort of a crude term, was starting to become crude in the sense that the East has produced a lot of different things, and so the group and all is one is somewhat crude. But the idea of oneness, the idea of an ultimate harmony of all that exists, an ultimate identity, a oneness, sort of an ultimate ontological integration. So I was attracted by the idea of an ultimate oneness, and yet I was also deeply impressed and inspired by the notion of a God. Now, oftentimes theisms, religions, are sort of committed to very dualistic things, like we fall so far short of the glory of God. God's like way out there, and we're way down here, and no one has ever seen God, and so it's just, there's such a gulf of separation. On the other hand, monism, pure monism, that everything is just one, it can't be the complete truth, because the world is nothing but variety. If everything was the same color, you wouldn't have the notion of color. You need at least two colors to even have the idea of color. If everything in the world is the same tone or hue, certainly sound, you couldn't have the notion of melody unless you had more than one note. And all of us are unique. I mean, every organ of our body is unique. It's like there's just, everything is variety, and yet it all hangs together. So it was what really was sort of the knockout punch for me, what really kind of brought me on board, was an ontological point about the nature of existence, that things are one and different at the same time. To give a simple example, consider this room right now. Here we're all sitting here. We're all sitting here, and so there are two ways that cognitively, there are two ways that you can get at the reality of this event. In Sanskrit, these are called vyasa and samasa. Vyasa means putting things apart. Samasa means putting them together. So you can understand this scene here by noticing there are different people sitting in different places with different appearances. You can notice that every person has their own unique way of dressing and grooming themselves, that every individual body has different limbs, that there is a ceiling, a floor, there are walls, there are windows, there are different colors in the room. In other words, you could just examine all the variety of this scene. But, so that's the vyasa, sort of dividing things into all the components. However, in order to be a sane, conscious person, you can't just, you know, fall into the Humpty Dumpty syndrome. You have to be able to put everything back together so that if you think about it, although we perceive the almost unlimited variety just in this room, we can experience this as a single, seamless event. It's us in the room. So you have to be able to put it all together seamlessly, and yet you have to be able to divide it up into all the components. And it's these two cognitive actions by which we understand, we're conscious, I mean, at a very basic level. So there must be a sense in which all that exists is one seamlessly, and yet there's variety. There's a sense in which God and ourselves is a single reality, and there's a sense in which I'm an individual and you're an individual and God is an individual. So it was this discovery on my part of simultaneous oneness and variety that I thought really was very important. Another important thing for me in my decision to pursue a particular spiritual path was I was looking for a practice. It's like, you know, I'd studied music, I was in the university, I'd learned different arts, I was sort of athletic. So I mean, I had plenty of experience that when you want to get good at something, whether it's music or sports or school, whatever, you've got to practice. And I wanted to be in higher consciousness. And so I took it for granted that there must be some disciplined spiritual practice which can systematically elevate me to an expanded understanding. And so I wasn't just looking for a doctrine or like believe this. I wasn't looking for just for faith. I was looking for a practical spiritual method to bring me to a realized understanding of these things so that all these spiritual ideas became as real and as palpable to me as anything else around me. And also, just hope I'm not giving you more than you bargained for, but one final point is that I was very blessed to have very good loving parents and to grow up in a place that had unusually good weather, Southern California. And back in a time when it wasn't the world capital of road rage. But anyway, so I mean, and to this day, I feel myself to be just unlimitedly fortunate that I get to be a conscious person. I think personal life, to have friends, to have family, to appreciate music, to pursue justice, to have the power as an individual seed of consciousness to explore the universe and to inquire about the highest things. Personal life. Personal life, I think, is just the most wonderful thing in the world. And therefore, a spiritual theory which rejects all this and says that it's just a big mistake. All of your personal life is a mistake, and when you become enlightened, you'll just sort of radiate. You'll just shine. You'll just, in other words, in order to be spiritually advanced, you have to sort of kill your ego, kill your personality. To me, it's monstrous. I mean, me personally, I mean, that's just my personal view. It's. I want to be a person, but I want to be a better person. To use the word they always used, I know, in 18th, 19th century English jargon or literature, that to improve oneself, that human life is meant to improve oneself, to refine oneself by learning, by cultivating better character, by deepening one's spiritual understanding, to improve oneself.
How did you know that you were ascending spiritually, not descending or upstanding level?
Yes.
Did you have a measure of
it?
Sort of pH meter that said you're getting better, getting redder, redder.
Yeah. I found that I was becoming, for me, miraculously free of all kinds of selfish desires. Having entered into a very dedicated hedonistic period of my life when I was in college. I guess that's what college is for. So I found that I was becoming free of these things, and that the experience of gradually becoming free of selfishness, lust, and greed, and vanity was sublime. Because even before I began this, I mean, any intelligent person can see through their own vanity and can understand sometimes that my motives are petty or unworthy, and that I with my intelligence, I can envision a more noble life for myself, and yet I'm sort of pulled down by the gravity of my own selfishness. And so to actually be empowered to... It's almost like cutting the anchor which was holding me down in a life of just gross selfishness, and being able to really act for the benefit of others. And an experience of God which was so powerful, so beautiful, so pleasurable, that those things which I formerly was attached to because I enjoyed them began to seem insignificant. Not dogmatically, because, you know, it says in the good book that these things are evil, but by actually experiencing a much, much greater pleasure, more sublime, and a pleasure which, unlike my other pleasures, was not based on exploiting other people and other things, exploiting their bodies. It was not a pleasure based on vanity, thinking I was better than other people. It was actually a pleasure which included everyone. It was a pleasure based on a worldview in which every living thing was equal to me.
Did you ever achieve peace? Was that part of your aim?
Peace? I guess when I was 20 years old, and I guess I was just peace. I guess I was too young to really think too seriously about peace. But
I didn't mean world peace, I meant inner peace.
Yeah, yeah, very much. Very, very much. And of course, naturally, when you know, when you take a spiritual practice, of course, it's not that instantly one becomes perfect. And so it's really a lifelong journey. It's a lifelong project. And to this day, I'm very much a work in progress, but keyword progress. And I see even today in my life, I've been practicing, I guess I'd say seriously practicing, for, 38 years. Is it 38? 39? How old am I? Yeah, 38. So, conveniently forgot my age. So, So yes, it continues. I continue to progress. And so almost like you'd say, if not every day, every week, every month, I feel like I've crossed another hurdle. It's almost like you're learning a musical instrument, and you just always have trouble with a certain passage.
And so when you look at your life, then, this is really why I came here, to hear how a Westerner approaches the spiritual values of the East. When you, where you say that you're constantly sort of growing, do you look at things, and then you've talked about hurdles or whatever, do you look at things in the past that made you either unhappy or that you feel were bad that you did, that now you no longer have those motives to be bad or quote bad, or do you have measurements that yes, I enjoy something more than I used to enjoy, or how do you measure?
Well, both.
Can you give some examples?
Yes, if I'm forced, I will confess. From a young age, because I was in a new spiritual society that was relatively new in the West, from a very young age, I was put in a position of leadership. And so at the age of 25, I was made responsible for about 20 countries, thousands of people, and it was, poor people. But I mean, in one sense, it went very well. I, for example, went to Latin America, and I was overseeing many, many countries there, and the results were very good. I mean, everything was growing and flourishing. And in retrospect, I can see that, I think, because I was, well, you can always blame everything on youth, because I was not as purified as I am now. I don't claim to be perfect, but I'm certainly more mature now than I was then. I can see that in the way I could have been kinder in certain situations. I could have been more understanding and patient. And I can see that sort of a combination of maturity and pride. So it's, yeah, I can see in different ways how at the present time I feel I'm able to do things more appropriately, do some things in a more worthy manner than I could then because of the state of consciousness I was in. I could go on all night about all the stupid things. So, anything else?
Yes. Is it through reading or talking to people that keeps raising you up? What is it that you bring into yourself that changes you?
Well, I have a spiritual practice I do, which in Sanskrit is called sadhana, and in the yoga traditions, certainly from India, every path, every tradition has their sadhana, their practice. And so in my own case, it involves getting up very early in the morning. I mean, when I'm not traveling and jet-lagged and discombobulated, say around 4 o'clock in the morning, and which is easy if you get to bed early enough, getting up, and then we do japa, which is chanting on beads. I mean, the beads are just a way of counting, regulating. I mean, the beads aren't intrinsically the spiritual practice. It's just sort of a pre-industrial way of counting. So, chanting and studying and service, whatever food we eat, we offer. We had a discussion last night. And Louise, you were there, right? We discussed this, that here's the basic explanation very quickly of how the purification takes place. First, the idea behind it. Rerun. Whenever we clean something, whether it's cleaning our clothes or cleaning a dish or a car or a rug or cleaning an electronic apparatus, cleaning involves bringing the object we're cleaning into contact with something pure or purer, which cleanses it, whether it's pure water. I mean, you can't really wash your car with dirty water. You have to wash your car with clean water. Some things are cleaned with air. For example, there are those little things you spray air into, like your computer or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not a technical person, but you know, spray air into things. Or you may beat a rug, or there are certain metals that are purified by fire. you know, you can purify certain metals by putting them in fire. So whether it's fire, water, air, or just beating, there are different ways to purify things. So when we talk about purifying consciousness, in order to purify consciousness, we have to bring consciousness directly into contact with something very pure. And that contact, the Sanskrit word for contact is yoga. That's actually what the word means. In fact, we have traces of the Sanskrit word yoga in English words like yoke, to yoke two things together, to connect them, or jug, as in conjugal. So, in a sense, it's just like in the physical realm, if you're cleaning your clothes are physical things and water is a physical thing, so they can kind of interact. So we bring consciousness into contact with pure consciousness, the pure consciousness of God. And the way this is done, and the way it's been done actually in every world religion, major world religion, there are many ways you can do it. But one common way, I mean to say, is through the name of God. Whether you read the Lotus Sutra of the Buddhists or all the world religions. The idea is that that God is an absolute being. And as an absolute being, God's name is actually God. In other words, God is fully present in that name and that vibration. This comes up in a Platonic dialogue where Socrates is wondering, like, do certain Greek words actually embody the things they name? What's the relation between a word and the object itself? Of course, in the material level, it's not like that, like water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. I mean, the word water, you can't drink it. You can't say the word water and quench your thirst. But the idea is, on the spiritual platform, that a sound, a vibration, if you like.
Do you hear the water there? Just as you were talking, the music, somebody's using water in the sink. Just as you said it.
I know, I pushed a button here. I have a little keyboard here.
Your own sound effects.
So the holy name of God, the name, and as I said, probably in all spiritual traditions, if you look at their history, they have this. So the idea is that by chanting or singing the name of God, any language, I mean any tradition, any language, whether it's just some nickname you have yourself for God, it's sort of like the amazing thing about the spiritual reality is that if you really intend to say the Supreme Being, that's actually your sincere intention, then the vibration you make actually becomes assimilated into the spiritual realm. And so that vibration, somehow God is present in that vibration. And so by chanting or singing or saying or meditating or just, you know, whatever you like best, you're actually directly in contact. You establish a state of yoga. The physical exercises of yoga, the postures, the breathing exercises, were actually preliminary processes. They were just to get you in shape, so to speak. It's like before, you would say you go out and play tennis. You may stretch or sort of get yourself in shape in different ways, build up your stamina and so on. But all those exercises to prepare yourself physically for the tennis game, that's not tennis. Tennis is when you actually go out and hit the ball around. And so in the same way, the Ashtanga Yoga, Ashta 8, Ocho, so the Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-limbed yoga, which is sort of like the original yoga system, Patanjali describes it in the Yoga Sutras. The first stage is yama niyama, which is sort of like moral duties and trying to develop certain virtues so that the person practicing yoga is a good person, is self-controlled, and so on. And then asana, the posture, literally means sitting, asana, the postures. It's become sort of very athletic now in the West because people want a real workout, but the asanas are the sitting poses, and then yama niyama asana, pranayama, the breathing exercises, and then pratyahara, which literally means counter perception, the sense of you bring all your senses in. The senses are all sort of roaming about, and you bring your senses inward, pratyahara, and then dharana, which means kind of hold on. make you bring your senses in, you kind of hold on to that state, and then dhyana, you begin to meditate. Then you begin to meditate, and finally samadhi, where the mind experiences the truth. So, in that state of samadhi, one is directly connected to that truth through consciousness. The amazing thing is, in this age, there are different processes which are recommended for different ages because of the different conditions we're in. And so in this age, utilizing this name, the name of God, is recommended because the original yoga system, not what people do necessarily today, which is good, it's not bad, but the original yoga system was extremely demanding. For example, one thing Krishna mentions in the Gita is ekaki, you should live alone. You should be in a secluded place. You should be in a sacred place. And one had to sit for extremely long periods of time, years actually, in meditation. So it's very difficult for most people nowadays. So although the yoga exercises are very good, I mean, it is beneficial. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. It's beneficial. But ultimately, to really reach that samadhi, that state of perfect connection with God, it said in this age you can instantly place yourself in a state of yoga, of being linked, by chanting the names of God. As I said, in any language, we have our favorite little chants and everything, but it can be any language, any tradition, it's not sectarian, and that by direct contact with that vibration, which is pure, it actually begins to purify your consciousness. Another point, we have to connect all of our faculties to that truth. So that when we eat, if we, in a simple way, if we offer that food to its source, to the God who gave it, then the food is transformed. This is a practice which you observe in all ancient civilizations. I know if you read Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, no civilized person ever eats anything until they've offered it to the God. So this notion that there's a cosmic cycle, that we receive gifts, that food is a gift and it must be offered back to complete the cycle before we partake of it. So in that way, we actually can reconstitute our body as a spiritual body. We can actually construct a spiritual body even in this world by eating spiritual foodstuffs. Music, dancing, we talked about dancing yesterday. That if you dance for the pleasure of God, as King David did in the Old Testament, singing and dancing, if you dance for the pleasure of God, then all of your bodily energy becomes an offering. And so another way to spiritualize your body, using your intellect spiritually, everything, your art, whatever artistic ability you have, your work. Let's say if you work and you have a house, you can meditate upon your dwelling as an ashram. You can meditate upon the fact that God lives in your house. And that in cleaning your house, decorating your house, paying for your house, that actually you are providing a dwelling place for the Lord. An example of this, I guess it's Old Testament night. If you look in the Old Testament, when the first temple was built in Jerusalem, it said everywhere in the Old Testament, in terms of planning the project, building the temple, the grand opening, everything, it said over and over and over again that it's a temple to the name of God. That as God lives in heaven, his name will live in the temple. So simply by, again, chanting these names, even your home becomes an ashram. It becomes a spiritual place. So every aspect of our life, every faculty, practically, can be spiritualized, connected to God. So your whole life becomes yoga. Your eating becomes yoga. Your singing and dancing is yoga. Your studies, your friendships, your family, everything, your entire life is... What is it Krishna uses in the language in the Gita? Samagram praviliyate. That your entire existence is absorbed into the spiritual realm. And everything becomes purified and we become fully lucid. It's like if someone's sick and they just don't feel well, you lose your appetite, lose your enthusiasm to do things just because you're sick. But as you start to get healthy, this is also, I believe, relevant to what you asked, that when you're really getting your health back, you just feel good. You get your appetite back. You want to go outside. You want to do things. You want to talk to people. It's like you come back to life. And so spiritual progress is very much like that. It's just coming back to life. spiritually and developing a real appetite for spiritual things and beginning to see gross material pleasures for the trivialities they are. So again, it's not artificial. It's not like a dogma that the body is evil. The body's not evil. It's actually divine. It's a divine gift meant to be used. It's a gift meant to be used for spiritual progress. It's an extraordinary, invaluable instrument which you can use to make spiritual progress.
When you're at home, how many hours do you spend in the practice?
Excuse me?
When you're at home, how many hours do you spend in your practice?
You mean the chanting itself as opposed to the service?
Everything that's involved in it.
Oh, basically that's all I do. In the sense that I'm always either working at various projects which have spiritual intent or chanting or so, lecturing. I admit I take a little recreation, which Krishna recommends in the Gita, a little recreation. But again, it's kind of like an offering to God. I play classical music on the keyboard, and I sort of do that as an offering. And we had a volleyball tournament the other day. Keep healthy. Keep the body healthy.